Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal. I'm here with my co-host, Donna Prusgintis. Donald on the Kitchen comes to you at noon on Tuesday and repeat at 7 o'clock Tuesday evening. If you just can't get enough of this fine program. We are coming to you from KHOI Community Radio, and we get by with a little help from our friends. The Donald on the Kitchen Show is supported by Farm to Folk, an Ames-based food cooperative connecting you to local farmers all year round, including organic meats and produce. More information at farmtofolk.com. The following is an encore presentation of the Donald on the Kitchen Show. Sometimes a show is just too good not to reheat and air again, so we hope you enjoy this encore presentation. Also, if you're interested in any past Donald on the Kitchen Show, you can find them all archived on the KHOI website. Go to khoifm.org. Find the talk section. Find Donald on the Kitchen. Pull down that little marker there, and you can find archives from all our past shows and recipes and some other stuff, too, including a fine picture of Donna and I. Enjoy the show. Yes, we do. This is the Donald on the Kitchen. This is KHOI Community Radio. Welcome to our kitchen table. Yes. Today, we have Carolyn Ratzenberger as a guest in our kitchen. We will consider something called the precautionary principle. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you. I want to introduce Carolyn. She is the director and founder of Science, Health, and the Environmental Network. Now, this is a national organization.
Let me just correct the name, the Science and Environmental Health Network.
Oh, I always reverse that. Pardon my dyslexia there.
We actually rehearse this and we try this so that I get to say what it is.
Okay. but I want you to know that even though it's a national organization, Carolyn actually lives here in Ames, making her one of our local heroes. Thank you for joining us, Carolyn.
Oh, my pleasure.
So Carolyn is a lawyer by training and an anthropologist before that. And she puts all of this into constructing the rights of future generations and works with those principles. She's also been very involved in the No Bakken Pipeline, the North Dakota Access Pipeline, and she has lots of things to talk to us about. Carolyn, do tell us all of these comforting things.
Well, before I start on that, I want to thank both of you for your role in nurturing the activist community. And just recently...
Yeah, we cook a lot of soup for them.
Really? So one of the things that I've learned, especially from Donna, is how food is more than food. It is community bonding. It is nurturing. It is ceremonial. So... Donna cooked for my sister's wedding, and I understood why the wedding feast is figures large in weddings, and why that kind of gathering around the table and the marriage of our bodies with food, the marriage of each other, the bringing together of community around such an extraordinary event as a wedding. I think you've taught me more than anybody else about what that might be.
Well, certainly eating is a rather elemental experience.
And you raise it to something far beyond that, to that great ceremonial.
Well, I hope it tastes good.
It tastes like nothing I've ever experienced. And just recently, Donna cooked for a group called the Women's Congress for Future Generations, and she cooked a gratitude dinner where we recognized that our activism of giving is actually a gift to the earth itself. And so the foods that she cooked, that you cooked, Donna, bison and wild rice, a water food, and apples. So these gifts of water, of the earth, of pollinators, and that our work as activists is actually is on behalf of those gifts, so that it's this call and response, it's this giving and receiving.
And I hope, I always find food is a very pragmatic, real element, you know.
It is. And so how better to express the gifts of the earth and then our gifts of service and activism back to the earth. So that particular meal was one that smelled beyond delicious. It tasted,
lots of garlic.
But it was the cinnamon and cardamom and other things. But we sourced that food, not cardamom, but other things, from local farmers. And so if you're listening to this and have raised some of the food, I think my body and the health of it has been spun out of Lana and Joe's kale and greens.
And garlic
over so many years. So I honor both of you for your contributions to the community and to the earth again. That call and response, your gifts have been gratefully received and recognized and acknowledged.
Well, thank you for those kind words, Carol, and that's great. Nurturing community is an important thing. And in your work, you take in community as a huge, huge subject, and you also think of community not just here and now, but community in the future. Talk to us. I've always been interested in this term, the precautionary principle. It sounds just good on its surface, but it has to do with the long term.
It's very sensible. Do tell us about it.
It does. And I'm going to start with the words themselves because I think we understand precaution. You know, that's a standalone word. Principle is one that we probably get on some level. But what does that actually mean? And so I'm going to back into a discussion of the precautionary principle with where those two words came from. They actually came out of a German word, which I'm not going to try to say. Well, yes, I will. I'm going to butcher that, and not as beautifully as as a real butcher. But the German word is Vorsorgeprinzip, and what it literally translates into is the forecaring principle.
Forecaring. F-O-R-E.
Yes.
Or F-O-R.
F-O-R-E.
Uh-huh.
Forecaring. Caring for what might be a difficult future. And I was really taken with that anew in this last week.
Oh, boy.
So regardless of who you voted for, we are facing a very different future. And the work that we had done on the precautionary principle looks ahead. It looks ahead and says that we need to prepare for a difficult future. Now, at the time that I began the work on the precautionary principle, I was living in North Dakota on a very large farm, very large organic and biodynamic farm, and I understood forecaring well. So living in North Dakota in the summertime, we were gathering wood for our wood stove. We were canning and freezing and gardening. We worked sun up.
It sounds like the ant and the grasshopper.
Oh, absolutely. And so we were preparing for the winter. I was in North Dakota in 1996 and 97 for a winter that was unspeakable. So we had blizzards in April and then a big fire in Grand Forks. I had not been gardening much. I had not filled my larder. And I ended up in our house way out in the middle of nowhere, North Dakota. I lived in Windsor, town of 11. And we lived
sounds like Ole Rovog still out there.
And we lived 2 miles outside of town, so we were actually suburbanites. And the rest of the town had 9 people. And so I got snowed in. I got snowed out. And when I was snowed in, I had no access to food. And I said I would never allow that to happen again. So, yeah, we had food in our freezer because we raised our own wheat and we raised our own meat and we raised lots of stuff. But I did not have, the foods that would round out a whole meal. And I said that would never happen to me again. And so I set out to prepare every summer. and carry over enough in case I had a failed harvest for the next year. So that meant I had to think really carefully about a year and a half in advance because I didn't know what was coming. I knew that it could be impossible. And so this work on the precautionary principle, this forecaring, preparing for what might be a difficult future, emerged out of a German concept of preventing harm in the face of scientific uncertainty. Now, yes, canning in the middle of the summer is actually linked to dealing with scientific uncertainty. So what we were facing at the time that I began the work on the precautionary principle was that environmental policy was based on something called risk assessment, which was we analyzed the possible risk of some activity or a chemical or climate change, and then we decided what was an acceptable risk. And we couldn't interfere in market, you know, whether it's a pesticide or whether it was a genetically modified organism, unless we had certainty about the harm that it would cause. As we thought, some risks, some cancers in children are acceptable, some disabilities are acceptable, and so we're going to tolerate them. And the Germans had built into their environmental policy this idea called the precautionary principle. And it's a legal idea
in Germany, mm-hmm.
and in the United States after our work. And so what it said was it was written into the Rio Declaration. It's been written into two international treaties. It's the basis of San Francisco's environmental policy. It's all been reorganized. It's the basis of some laws in California governing environmental justice, many other situations. It's the basis of the treaty that binds together the European Union called the Maastricht Treaty. So it's a robust and fully fledged law, and we were part of helping to make it so. So this idea of forecaring, that doesn't tell you what to do, and it doesn't really tell you how scientific uncertainty is connected. So here's how it works. The precautionary principle has three elements. The first is the likelihood of harm. So what's the harm you're worried about? Are you worried about increases in cancer or neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's? Are you worried about more cancers? Are you worried about the loss of pollinators? Are you worried about the acidification of the ocean? What are you worried about? What's the harm that we're facing? And then there's scientific uncertainty. We don't know how big the harm is going to be. We don't fully understand cause and effect. There might be, you know, lots of dimensions to scientific uncertainty.
You mean we don't know everything as a human species?
We don't. I've just read yesterday that there's a new phase of water, that there's something, not just steam, that, you know, the gas, the
gas,
the,
solid, and liquid.
There's something in between that happens and why that is. We don't even fully understand.
So we've
water.
Just discovered this.
We've just discovered
so
this.
So my chemistry class in the 60s was wrong.
Probably not wrong, but it's being augmented.
Incomplete.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
We're always learning new things. So, you know, the best example is smoking. Up until the mid-1990s, mm-hmm. The tobacco executives could say with a straight face that that tobacco didn't cause cancer, lung cancer. Now, we had pretty good evidence that it not only caused lung cancer, it caused bladder cancer and lots of other things. But they could say that because the proof, excuse me, the proof of causation is very difficult. And there's a set of criteria that were established by a man named Bradford Hill that have seven criteria for proving causation in epidemiology. And so there's some common sense things, like the cause has to happen before the effect. You know, there's things like that. You have to understand the biological mechanism. How does it cause, say, cancer or Parkinson's or autism? How does it do that? And you have to fulfill all seven of those criteria before you could prove causation. So we couldn't prove causation with tobacco and lung cancer for one reason. We had six of the criteria nailed down by the early 1990s, but we did not have the biological mechanism. We didn't know how it caused cancer. So for lots of other things.
Yeah, because there's a lot we don't understand about cancer, among other things.
Yeah. So let's just take learning disabilities. We know that the increase in learning disabilities and autism, developmental disabilities, have increased quite rapidly over the past 25 years. And we don't fully understand that. But we do know that, for instance, some pesticides are interfere with the neurodevelopment of various species. Uh-huh. Well, and we know that they cross the placenta because mm-hmm. they're in cord blood. Mm-hmm. So what do we need to wait until we have all seven of Bradford Hill's criteria nailed down, or can we actually say accept that there's enough evidence of harm with, say, five or four of Bradford Hill's criteria when our children's brains are at risk? So the precautionary principle says scientific uncertainty shouldn't block precautionary action. Well, that's the third element, action. So you have the threat of harm, you have some scientific uncertainty, and then you have precautionary action. What's so unique about the precautionary principle is that it requires action. It doesn't require you sitting there dithering and saying, oh, whaley, 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 let's get more studies. It says you take action. It's a very forward-thinking idea. So what are those actions that we can take? And before I mention those actions, how we actually carry out the precautionary principle, I want to tell you the mysterious magic ingredient of the precautionary principle. So you heard that there's a whole body of science and philosophy in the middle of that idea, scientific uncertainty. There's a whole discipline in philosophy called epistemology that looks at how you know, who knows, how you deal with scientific uncertainty. A whole edifice of science is built on that. You know, the confidence levels, kinds of errors that you make. It's deep and heady and complicated, and I've spent years of my life thinking about it and studying it.
It's a large industry.
Scientists often don't study scientific uncertainty. But the magic ingredient is that there's another philosophical body of thought that underlies the precautionary principle, and that's ethics. So I met with someone
Hallelujah.
From the National Institute of Health who early on in the work that we've been doing on the precautionary principle said, huh. He said, that's the first decision rule. The decision rule is the basic algorithm by which we make decisions. Do we accept a GMO and allow it into commerce? Do we approve a pipeline? What are the decisions that we have to make and how do we make them? He says it's the first decision rule that he had ever heard that coupled epistemology with ethics. Well, that kind of surprised me. I'd been told my whole life we couldn't make decisions with our emotions, and I think they were conflating emotions with ethics, which is a bad mistake. You know, and don't challenge
Excuse
a mother.
Excuse me.
Don't challenge a mother whose baby's at risk. You know, she doesn't look at the scientific uncertainty when the truck is barreling at her child who's in the middle of the road. She grabs the kid out of the street.
An emotional response,
it's
right?
I would say
gut level.
Yeah, and an ethical one. Mm-hmm. And saying, oh, we should have left it to the scientist to calculate the risk of the truck swerving is ridiculous. So, when I heard that, I was flummoxed because I didn't know what the ethic was that he was talking about. Well, the whole thing about the precautionary principle is what I started with, and that is that we're preparing for a difficult future. And that the future
has certainly always been unknown.
It's been
unknown.
That's
the thing about the future.
Yes. And it's the idea that the precautionary principle sets a compass for us. And that the ethic is that our present generation takes responsibility for future generations and for their right to inherit a habitable planet. So the name tags that we had at the gratitude dinner that you cooked that fabulous meal for, they said beloved ancestor, and then they had a person's name. And I believe that the activists who are working on this, the pipeline, or to restore Iowa soils and to protect the water here, whatever it might be, to turn over the future in better shape than we got it, are truly beloved ancestors.
That's an excellent use of, an excellent explanation of what precautionary principle is. It talks to the ethics, the human in all of us. And we exist in time and space. We all have to deal with the future. You're listening to KHOI, Community Radio for the Heart of Iowa. I'd like to take a little time to tell you about KHOI. We need your support. This is our fundraising time. We talk about important things here. We talk about things that we need to consider. That's a good use of community radio. This radio station has been going for 4 1/4 years already. Can you imagine that we are that old? My goodness, 4 1/4
yeah,
years.
All with total community support.
Total community support. We are not owned, operated by a big conglomerate or an out-of-state sort of organization.
This or an in-state sort of organization.
This is Central Iowa. This is us here. We're 4 1/4 years old. August 15th, 2012, that's when it started. And much has happened since we've first turned on that transmitter. Lots of great shows, and lots of people have volunteered. It's fun to create radio. It's hard work to create radio. And we thank our members and supporters to provide financial funding to keep the station on the air. KHOI.
And we have...
This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. We are here in the Donna Lana Kitchen around our kitchen table talking to Carolyn Rassenberger. We've been talking about the future and ethics and the precautionary
principle.
And
how they must go together.
Somehow, yes. Carolyn has lots to say about the precautionary principle and how we should think about the world we live in and each other and how we plan for things.
And Carolyn, thank you for your thoughtful work for all of us. We have to somehow tread this territory always. And it's obviously become a little more paramount lately as we're changing tracks here in our national level. But there's hope. There's plenty of work to be done. And please show us some light here.
Well, I would like to speak to that because even years ago, I had students who felt that the Earth was on such a bad trajectory that there wouldn't be a rainforest or an ocean for them to protect when they were old enough to bring their skills and gifts to bear.
Yes, I'm afraid that's becoming more and more obvious.
I think so. And those young people said, why shouldn't we accelerate the destruction of the Earth? A kind of kamikaze destruction. Mm. And my answer was that it was a shock to hear that that's what young people thought. But it was an even more compelling idea that then I had an obligation to do everything I could to protect the Earth and to leave it in better shape than I got it. And I do want to speak to whether we're going to succeed or not. Obviously, it looks like we have less of a chance right now. But those are times when our our skills are even more required. We were not put on this earth at an easy time. And so it's worthy work. It is absolutely worthy work. I'm a lawyer by training and an archaeologist. I could be doing a lot of different things and off, you know, in the Bahamas or something, but this is worthy work. And so I call everyone to use your skills and your gifts to protect the earth, to stand with all of the voiceless in this truly dire time. And that the precautionary principle was a tool that helped the Science and Environmental Health Network and my colleagues there begin to look at the future. So one of the things I think that, you know, the astronauts did when they took a picture of the globe was change how we thought about space. Mm. And one of the things I think the environmental movement is doing now is thinking differently about time. And certainly climate change has brought that to the fore, that the future and long time frames are now on the table, that we are not only threatening the seventh generation, but much farther into the future. So a lot of my indigenous friends said to me, well, the precautionary principle is the seventh generation rule. And
tell us about the seventh generation rule is the language that have been used by the Native Americans.
By the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois Confederacy. They said that we should make decisions with the seventh generation in mind. So you can see why the precautionary principle, with its very forward-thinking ideas, came to bear and to be identified with the seventh generation rule. And a few years ago, I was called to do some work on a mine called the Giant Mine in the Northwest Territories up near Yellowknife, up by the Arctic Circle.
A gold mine,
uh-huh. An abandoned gold mine. And they wanted me to look at how to take care of it far into the future.
It's obviously very toxic.
Very toxic. Arsenic trioxide. And thousands of acres of arsenic trioxide poisoning the water, destroying the land.
And this is in northern Canada?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so
there are people who live there.
There are. Mm-hmm. Two tribes. The town of Yellowknife is right on the edge. And so I began looking at facilities that we are now charged with caring for 250,000 years. And when you move from seven generations to 10,000 generations, we're talking about geologic time. And so we have, you know, things like the Waste Isolation Pilot Project, which stores transuranic waste in New Mexico. And so it seems to me that when we've jumped in terms of thinking about seven generations and 250,000 generations, we have an entirely different
option. Yeah, some very mind-boggling numbers.
So we have to turn that compass. And the compass that I've turned my my heart and soul and work towards is, you know, that North Star of future generations. And I do not know that we'll succeed, but it's truly worthy work. And without everyone dedicated to that premise, we're not going to be very successful. So the Science and Environmental Health Network works in coalitions. And if you want to look up some of our work, at www.sehn.org, you can see the kinds of coalitions that we worked in. And one that we're actually the fiscal sponsor for the Bakken Pipeline Resistance Coalition. The Bakken Pipeline is the same pipeline as the Dakota Access Pipeline. Our coalition was created before Dakota Access was actually incorporated. We knew that they were.
And this is right in our backyard, folks. You didn't know,
it's less than 2 miles from the studio where we're speaking right now.
And we will have a pumping station in Ames as well.
We will. Just outside of Ames on near I-35. And so you may have heard about it both from local media and especially if you've listened to this radio station. KHOI has been formidable and in its bearing witness to what we have been doing to protect the...
Well, there's a lot to look at.
The drinking water of Des Moines and others. So we have always held a special niche in coalitions because of bringing this this preparation for future, laying out ideas that can be used, forging the tools.
In terms of legal expertise.
Not just legal, scientific and legal.
Ah, yes.
And ethical. So putting together essentially
all three of them.
The kinds of decision rules that we need to make wise decisions. So when we come back to the precautionary principle, it's a great idea. Do something right in the face of uncertainty, but that doesn't tell you what to do.
Right, right.
So there are five ways that we have come up with for implementing this idea of for caring. The first one is set goals. What kind of world do you want to live in? Would we like to start changing the trend lines? So we have filthy water in Iowa. We know that. There are lawsuits where the city of Des Moines is suing county boards and drainage districts for their contribution to the nitrates in the drinking water of Des Moines. We know that they're already threatened. We have a pipeline that Dakota Access thinks is going to go in across the Des Moines River and several other rivers. How do we set goals for water quality in Iowa? So setting a goal is the first step in getting to where you want to go. So you can't set a compass direction unless you know where you want to head. Setting goals is the first idea in implementing the precautionary principle. And the second is heeding early warnings. So what are the trend lines? The trends are actually scientific data. You may not fully understand cause and effect, what's causing the rate of autism to skyrocket or what's causing monarch butterflies to decline so precipitously. But heeding early warnings is actually a first step in beginning to take action and addressing scientific uncertainty. So we have ways of doing that already. We've got an early warning system for adverse vaccine reactions. Whatever you think about vaccines, there is a federal law and a federal reporting system where physicians
and a database
for adverse vaccine reactions. We are obligated to report them so that we can keep track of what's happening with vaccinations. So,
do we have a dead butterfly reporting service?
We don't, but we could create one.
Dead bees?
We can create those kinds of things. So heeding early warnings and coupled with the kinds of setting goals that you want with those.
And a good early warning is, of course, that we are now having the hottest year on record several years consecutively. That is an early warning.
It's an early warning. So we can argue about cause and effect. Is it human caused or not? We can argue. What can we do? And do we want to continue on that trajectory? Do we want that trend line to continue going in that direction? And what are the implications if they do? So heeding those early warnings. And right now I would say we're in the late warnings for climate change. A third thing that we can do is to look for alternatives to harmful activities. So if you have neurotoxicant pesticide, something that damages the neurological functioning of children and old people. And by the way, old people are often as vulnerable as children. They have a more permeable blood-brain barrier. There are lots of reasons why old people are also more fragile in a toxic environment. Are there alternatives to those kinds of pesticides? Are there alternatives to burning fossil fuels? Well, we know the answer to those. Yes.
Yes, there are.
I'm sitting two seats away from an organic farmer who is able to produce food without using chemicals that damage the brains of children.
I'm sitting 2 feet from a woman that drives an electric car.
Not quite an electric, a Prius.
Oh, right. It's a hybrid.
It's a hybrid.
We're very close. We have alternatives.
We're working on it, yes.
Yeah,
and this radical alternative idea of keep it in the ground. I mean, yes, we could, like, keep all those fossil fuels in the ground. We have to set these goals. We have to talk about it. We have to put it into our brain.
Right. And so looking for the best alternative and choosing it We actually have experience with this in federal, and many states have laws that are comparable. So the National Environmental Policy Act requires you to do an environmental impact statement, and in that, you have to look at other alternatives to an activity that's going to harm the environment. So one of the ideas that's contested with the Bakken Pipeline, the Dakota Access Bakken Pipeline, is that they didn't do an environmental impact statement, so they didn't have to do
– whoa.
They didn't have to look for the alternatives.
Does that mean they didn't follow the rules, basically?
They had actually changed the rules, so they didn't have to do that.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so that so looking for the best alternative was part of the contested ground around Dakota Access. So the Army Corps of Engineers would have been charged with doing an environmental impact statement and then looking for the alternatives to the Bakken Pipeline. The fourth is something idea is pretty interesting, and that is the notion of reversing the burden of proof, which is a legal idea. And so when
the notion reversing the burden of proof.
Yeah. Okay. So if you've got contested issues, so we don't know if the pipeline's going to leak or not. And so you've got environmentalist Carolyn Raffensperger sitting there saying, oh, it's going to leak, it's going to leak. And you've got Dakota Access saying, no, it's not going to leak. Who has the burden of proof? So the way that we currently make decisions, I have to show that it's actually going to leak and that it's going to cause irreparable harm and that that harm can't be fixed with money. And, you know, it goes on and on and on. And that's a very high standard.
And the only way you can prove that is just past examples. There's no way of knowing,
yeah,
really.
That's right. And so they come in and say,
probability.
Well, yeah. And they come in and say, oh, no, you know, we built it better than the last time. And besides, we can clean it up. And besides, we put in these valves, and so we can shut it off. And we're going to do that. You know, so because I have the burden of proof, the public, you and I hold the burden of proof in that face of uncertainty in the way that we make decisions now. We will almost always get the polluting pipeline. Mm-hmm. And then when it pollutes, they're not going to pull that permit. They're not going to pull that permit. So my organization, the Science and Environmental Health Network, intervened before the Iowa Utilities Board, which is the governing body making decisions about crude oil pipelines in Iowa. And we argued that present generations got all the benefits, the 6 months of jobs in the state of Iowa, but the future generations were going to get the risk of the polluted water. And we argued in our final brief that Dakota Access should be required to they should pull their permit if there was a leak of over 100 barrels.
And you mean absolutely stop?
Stop it. Just yeah. There was no permit. And the Iowa Utilities
Board. So they have to be permitted on an ongoing basis then.
Or if there was any leak. Uh-huh. But the Iowa Utilities Board refused to grant that condition to their permit.
Ooh-hoo.
So we have the burden of proof in that – the public should not carry the burden of proof in the face of really polluting and damaging technology.
Right, because the mistake is huge.
Yeah.
And so, depending, likely irreversible.
So essentially what we're asked to do is to pay for their gamble. If their gamble goes bad, we're asked to pay for it. And that's not a fair trade. But the last idea is also very interesting. So we've got setting goals, heeding early warnings, looking for the best alternative.
But this gambling sounds very familiar in our public governmental life.
It is. And then reversing the burden of proof so that we don't take that gamble. The fifth is really interesting. It is democratic participation in these decisions. So the Iowa
what a concept.
Yeah, so looking at democracy all the way around, you know, what is democracy? I would say that representative government has failed us because the Iowa Utilities Board was appointed by a governor. It was not an elected body. But even apart from the Iowa Utilities Board and that, why should Boone be forced to accept a pipeline when its elected representatives voted it down? So Boone County passed a resolution opposing the Dakota Access's Bakken Pipeline because They said they didn't have enough emergency responders. They weren't adequately trained. They didn't have enough equipment. They didn't like their water being threatened. There were endless reasons why they didn't want the pipeline. They knew that their drainage districts were threatened. So they said no. And so the way that we act, that I believe that the democratic principle should be carried out, is through something called free, prior, and informed consent. So most of us have heard consent in the context of sex, that if I do not give my free, prior, and informed consent to a sexual contact, it's assault or rape. And when a when people do not give their consent to something like a pipeline, then it should not be allowed to go through.
Is that called fascism or something?
Well, it can have lots of names.
It's called eminent domain, I think.
Well, that's certainly one, one part property owners. You know, they don't get a say in that. But so who should get consent to something like a pipeline? So this idea of free, prior, and informed consent has been developed on the international arena, and the Science and Environmental Health Network is trying to bring it to bear in all of our decision-making for things like pipelines. So the indigenous community around the world put into place the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And in that declaration, which has been approved by the United States and by Canada and others, says that indigenous people must give their free, prior, and informed consent to projects that affect their lives.
And when was this instituted into law?
Just recently.
So yeah, because we don't have a good history with that one.
No, we don't have a good history. But the idea of free, prior, and informed consent as a matter of so giving communities rights rather than just individuals is also a novel idea. So imagine if we had actually had free, prior, and informed consent for the pipeline.
In Iowa.
In Iowa. How would we have carried that out? And it would not could not be necessarily by representative government, but if we had had ballot measures, if we had had town hall votes, if we had had ways of giving or withholding consent. So that's the interesting thing about free, prior, and informed consent is that you can also withhold it. So, for instance—
So this sort of not in my backyard—
Not in anybody. Not
well, but
in,
if everyone said not in my backyard, there wouldn't be no backyards to put
right.
it in.
They're not, not in anybody's yard. So for instance, another area where that is true is that you can't have an experiment done on you as a human, medical or a scientific experiment done on you, without your free, prior, and informed consent. You can't be bought off. You have to have enough information about it. It has to be before the activity starts. And you know, consent is a really deeply embedded idea in governance. Without the consent of the governed, you don't have legitimate government. And so developing this idea for projects like the Bakken Pipeline is something that the Science and Environmental Health Network does. And it's part of the precautionary principle. Who better than the watchdogs for their drinking water, people who know and love the Des Moines River, to stop something and say, we do not give our consent to a crude oil pipeline crossing our drinking water.
Right, because who wants their drinking water polluted?
Who does? I mean,
nobody.
You're
nobody
an idiot if you
would
do.
Want that.
Yeah. So those ideas put together are how we implement the precautionary principle. And consent, so you'll hear arguments about the Bakken Pipeline. Oh, it's the safest. So it's safer than railroads. It's safer than trucking.
You know what? I have a story when people say that to me. I say, and this is a little crude, but you say, yes, it's traveling this oil around. It's sort of like saying, would you rather be raped by someone you know or someone you don't? Do you want it in an oil car or do you want it in the ground? The point is, you really don't – you don't want a train wreck in your town. We have lots of trains going through Ames, and a lot of them are carrying that oil. Do we want that? No. We don't want that either. That's a false either or.
Anytime you get an either or, it's first of all, it's a bad way to look for alternatives. Because the either-or is the logic of corporate dollars. So they say either you have DDT or you have sick and dying babies from malaria. Either you have the Bakken Pipeline or you don't get to drive your car. Either you have GMOs or we don't feed the world. So it's always the sick and dying baby or that's the – or jobs. Those are the two things.
Oh, yes.
But the alternatives idea.
It's called a false dichotomy, I believe.
Yes. So we know that there are ways other than fossil fuels. I mean, we're pioneering them in Iowa with wind and solar. We know that there are other ways of breeding seeds and of having a different kind of agriculture. So the look for better alternatives is always to find a safer way of meeting your goals without that sick either-or
trait. There are ways. There are safer, cleaner, healthier, better ways.
There are.
And I think changing our way of thinking, it's not really all that hard. We just have to tap into the human edge of things. Yes, we do. This is KHOI. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. And we come to you as a community radio station asking you to support this fine radio station. You can call 515-292-2878 or pledge securely online, khoifm.org. You can become part of an effort to improve community, improve dialogue, and be part of a positive community experience here at KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, and I just want to mention that good things do happen. Donna Lana Kitchen has been a part of this fine radio station for 3 years now. Who would have thought? I never thought I'd be in the radio again.
We didn't know we had that much to say.
Who knows? And we've had wonderful guests. By my count, going through our archives, we have got 126 shows that we have, put together. And here they are. And actually, they are available at khoifm.org. You can go to the Donna Lana Kitchen web page there, go to the talk section, pull down Donna Lana Kitchen, and you can find a plethora of things to do, and recipes. We have recipes there.
Yeah, we're very pragmatic.
Of course. So if you want to find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen, go there. And if you want to find out more about KHOI Radio, go to khoifm.org and push the magic donate button. Thank you for being with us today, Carolyn. You were talking about the importance of food and community, how it all works together. Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, and Carolyn, give that website one more time.
www.sehn.org. And we're helping to prepare for this difficult future.
And they also have a newsletter that you can sign up if you go to the website. I find it always current reading, very good material. Thank you, Carolyn.
You're welcome.
Right. The precautionary principle is something that we can, get into our brains. And we can do this.
Use it as a way of, taking off your rose-colored glasses sometimes.
It is a positive, positive thing. And, well, we've got something to discuss here, as usual, that is kind of serious, but it's important to know about. A friend told us about an article.
In Esquire magazine, as a matter of fact. And
it's about scientists and their relationship to the information that they are finding out about what's happening to our planet. The article is called, When the End of Human Civilization is Your Day Job. Among many climate scientists, gloom has set in. Things are worse than we think, but scientists can't really talk about it.
It's about denial within our culture and how strong it is. And it reminded me a lot of what we did on the show last week, because I've been reading a lot about kind of the despair that a lot of people are feeling about the general overall trends of our global civilization and how you deal with that, because it is so large. And most people, who are intimately involved in these sort of things, whether they're scientists or activists or even politicians that want to deal with this, or willing to deal with this, I should say, talk about how difficult it is personally. And I definitely, if I'm reading late at night some of this stuff that I follow, it's kind of, you think, oh, my grandchildren, you know.
Yes.
Existentially with this, because, you know, you can't give up, you know. There was a lot of talk at the Prairie Festival last year, too, about the nature of hope. Now, one needs hope. I think it's part of our human psyche, and it's very, very necessary. But hope founded on unrealistic things is, it's rather childish. So this article in Esquire is talking about an American climate scientist, young man, 42 or something, who actually moved with his family to Denmark.
Mm-hmm. His name is Jason Box. And he moved to Denmark because he was kind of told not to talk about his fears.
Right.
He's from
Colorado.
Yeah.
And there was another woman mentioned in there who moved to England, and she said, oh, even living in England is a relief because the amount of public pressure and just nastiness in the American discourse and the amount of people get life-threatening letters if they write about climate change. Yeah. I mean,
climatologist called Jason Box has been roundly forbidden and put down for expressing emotion about what he saw. Scientists aren't supposed to have emotion about this, and because he's a human being, he sort of reacted to what he was finding, and he said, "Hey, folks, this is important. This is nasty here." And showing emotion was ringed with taboos in all science, but especially in climate science. Climate scientists have been so distracted and intimidated by the relentless campaign against them that now, unfortunately, they tend to avoid any statements that might get them labeled as alarmists. So there they are, they're caught between a rock and a hard place with finding out all of this important information, but people don't want to hear it. And that includes us, I'm afraid.
Yeah,
but we're all in the same boat. Yeah, all these
gloomy
statements. All these gloomy statements. One person that received a lot of bad feedback was, do you remember the chart, the graph that was first shown as part of Al Gore's movie? When he first brought that out, there was this...
The hockey puck graph.
Where, okay, here's the climate going along in the centuries and the years. And then all of a sudden, it gets warmer and warmer. And all of a sudden, it just shoots right up. And in a sense, when it shoots right up, we pretty much all look at one another and we say, oh, we are dead right there. And that hockey puck graph was discovered and plotted out by a person called Michael Mann, who was a young PhD researcher when he came up with that historical data, the temperatures in the past and how they're...
And the sudden spike.
Yeah, and what he would say, putting all the information he has in here, what's going to happen in the next century or so. Now, you think we'd kind of take that information, okay, so fine, let's talk about this. No.
Let's deal.
It scared a lot. It scared me. But it scared a lot of people, too. He was investigated. He was denounced in Congress, got death threats, was accused of fraud. He received white powder in the mail and got thousands of emails with suggestions like, you should be shot and quartered and fed to pigs, unquote. So he got all kinds of pressure from his university, and a British journalist even suggested the electric chair. Now, this is somebody that plotted out a graph.
A scientist based on his work.
Yeah. So now this article in Esquire is about the scientists actually having a real emotional and psychological problems because they find out one thing, they turn around and present their work, and they are getting slapped upside the head.
Shoot the messenger.
It is. So I don't know if it's going to do us any good to shoot the messenger. That doesn't mean that the climate is going to change, but it's a very, very interesting art. We'll go out with a tune called Montgomery's Rant. Why not? We rant every now and then. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We've had a fine guest. Thank you, Carolyn, for joining us. We learned about the precautionary
Carolyn
principle.
Carolyn Raffensperger of Science
and Environmental
Health Network.
Yes. My name is Lana Nocticle.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.
Woohoo!